Welcome back to the next session of the class on Ecclesiastes, searching for the meaning of life. We left off in the last session at the end of chapter 6, where Solomon kind of went through a series of inspections and a couple anecdotes on life about the uselessness, pointlessness, and meaninglessness of wealth, riches, honor, large family, living a long life, so longevity and wisdom. And just that all of this didn't actually matter if somebody was left unsatisfied and unable to enjoy the good in life. Here in chapter 7, as we begin, Solomon's going to list just a whole series of proverbs, and it's really difficult to kind of understand how they connect together. Some of them have connections, other ones are just kind of standalone. But we'll see his whole point at what he's trying to do by laying this out toward the end of the chapter. So let's get started. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than good perfume, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. So the comparison here in both these lines is playing off of the better than kind of structure. You have the name of a person, and a good name is better than good perfume. Now, why isn't that like a kind of like self-evident thing, though, that your personal reputation and name is like more valuable than a bottle of smelly ointment? You'd figure so. But what he's trying to say is that a good name is more valuable than something that is expensive. Now, in the ancient world, good perfume was very expensive and was very valuable and costly. So to have a good, he's trying to elevate the superiority and preference of a good name, even over something that is very expensive and costly, that a good name is even more than that. And then the second line here, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Now, this one might be a little bit more of a head scratcher, because you probably ask the question, why is it better when I die than when I'm born? And to answer that, we'd have to think about Solomon's framework of what life consists of, and also in relationship, perhaps, to the first line of the good name, that when somebody dies, their name is essentially memorialized because their life is lived and then it's over. And whatever their name was, whatever their reputation was, it's then fixed. Because when you die, you can't change your reputation and the way people recognize and look at you. But the day you're born, you have no name. You have your whole life ahead of you to develop it. And in Solomon's view, there's no guarantee that you're going to live life in the way that then produces a good name. So if you have a good name, then the day you die is better, because your good name is then preserved. Whereas the person who just gets born, there's an unknown future that lies ahead for them, and they could make bad choices and turn out to not develop a good name in their life. In verse 2, as we continue on with this better than structure, Solomon says it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all humankind, and the living should take this to heart. It's better to go to the house of mourning. This is just a reference to a funeral, basically. In the ancient world, they didn't have funeral houses where you'd go to like view somebody in a casket. The people would bring the deceased into their home, and people would come to their home and would be with them in mourning and grieving over the death of the person. So Solomon's saying that it's better to go into a house where there's a funeral happening and somebody died, than to go into a house where there's a party. Now, if you guys have ever been to a funeral, or for example, maybe a wedding reception or something, there's a big difference. And if you had your choice, which would you prefer to go to? I'd say the joyous occasion sounds a little bit better to me than the dreary funeral atmosphere. I don't think anybody likes death. Normally, people don't like death. It's a painful experience. There's a lot of emotional hurt. There's a lot of tears and sorrow and sadness. Whereas For example, like maybe a wedding or a graduation or something where people are celebrating. It's festive. It's fun. It's lively. There's music. People are happy. That just seems to be a better choice. Well, depends on what your perspective is, as all things are here in the book of Ecclesiastes. For Solomon, he's concerned with trying to understand life. And if you're trying to understand life, going to a party won't get you a lot of understanding about life. A party actually is a little bit of a detour from life. Whereas if you go to a funeral, it definitely gets you to reflect on life. The somber tone and the seriousness of it prompt a person to think about life and to think about what is meaningful in life and what life consists of and how short it is. But when you're at a party, you're not thinking about those things. You're thinking about, oh, this is fun. Oh, this is great. We're having an awesome time. And you kind of forget about life. It's almost like a sort of a side detour of life for a moment before you then go back to normal. So Solomon here is saying the house of mourning is better because that is everybody's end. It's the end of all humankind. And the living should take this to heart. His point is that those who are alive, it really is better to be preoccupied with understanding life than to be busy with celebrating things in life. Now, he doesn't stay on that only. He then actually uses it to springboard into his next assertion that sorrow is better than laughter. For by the sadness of the face, the heart is made good. Again, Solomon, he's looking at life in the sense of how do you get to the answer of what matters? And he's saying sorrow is better. This goes along with being in the house of mourning. Sorrow's better than laughter. I don't know if I'd ever choose sorrow over laughter. But in terms of trying to be in an environment or a state of mind where I'm going to be reflecting on what matters in life, if I'm laughing and jolly, having a good time, I'm not thinking a lot about life. I'm not thinking about what the next year looks like in my life. I'm not thinking about, am I on a good path in life? I'm just living in the moment, having a good time. And so for Solomon, that's why sorrow is better. Sorrow takes you out of that and then brings to your mind all the more weighty and serious things of life to ponder the deeper questions and to realize the importance of knowing your days are limited. They're numbered. You don't know how many more of them you have. So then that would then help you understand, well, am I living in the way I should if my life is short and I don't know when it's going to be over? It brings the immediacy of life into the picture. Now, the second line here, for the sadness of the face, the heart is made good. The sadness of the face. When I'm hurting and my face is sad, I don't feel good about that. It's not a good feeling. Sadness doesn't make me feel good. It doesn't make my heart feel good. But that's not what Solomon's talking about here. It's not about feeling good. It's about his heart being made good. The pain of the death of a loved one and what it brings into a person's mind that then causes their face to be saddened, he's saying that ends up resulting in something good in their heart. Their heart takes to account what matters in life. That is good, he says. It's good that a person is in that place and that their heart is then improved because of it. This is sort of hard for us to think about in maybe like practical terms. But think about it from Solomon's perspective of he wants people to be, and he himself is trying to figure this out, but he wants people to think about life and the ultimate questions about it. And he says he doesn't think you can get there by laughing and celebrating. And so the sadness of the face is what then makes the heart good, because that is an avenue that can get you to those deeper concerns of life. And so that is why he then says in verse 4 that the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. The wise have their heart in the house with the funeral, because a wise person knows that that place is what brings the perspective that is needed in life. But the heart of fools is in the house of merrymaking. The house of feasting and the house of merrymaking are just interchangeable terms in Solomon's vocabulary. People who are in the house of merrymaking, they don't give a lot of thought to tomorrow or their own mortality. They just want to have a good time and enjoy the life in the here and now. The problem is that it's not wrong. Well, sorry, let me say that again. The problem is that it's not wrong to enjoy the moment. There's nothing wrong with it. The problem is that when we celebrate, and there's a time to celebrate, because Solomon says that there's a time for everything. There's a time for joy. There's a time for mourning. There's a time for dancing. There's a time for all these things under the sun, as we learned about in chapter 3. But his point is that that cannot be where we reside. We can't have our heart be in that place predominantly, because if we focus on celebrating and making merry and everything, then we won't take care to look at how we live and the universal future that we all share, which is death. And so once again, it's about being in the house of mourning that brings life into perspective, and the wise person knows that. There's a famous business aphorism that you might have heard. It's, you're supposed to begin with the end in mind. I think that's what Solomon's trying to say here, is that if you're looking at life, the end of life is death. So how we go from here to the end is important in light of what is there. And so what is there should inform and should influence how we get there. The famous book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, he uses this particular principle a lot and expresses it in terms of calculating the way that you, the steps you have to take to achieve a goal, which is the end. And if you know where you want to be, then you can back calculate from there the right way to achieve it, rather than trying to figure it out as you go, hoping that you end up in the place you thought you were going to be, which never really works out, does it? If you make it up on the go, usually you end up in a different place you thought you were going to be. The idea of wisdom here in verse 4, he brings in wisdom here in verse 4, and it's going to now be a major theme of his. How does wisdom play out in these different proverbs and apply to life? And the comparison between wisdom and foolishness is a prominent role, because the fool lives frivolously, a life of pleasure, while ignoring the reality of death. And Solomon has previously said that there's really nothing better than enjoying the pleasures of eating, drinking, and working, because this is the portion that God has given to humankind. And so they're supposed to rejoice in it, he says. But the difference is that the wise do this with an eye on the horizon and their feet firmly grounded in the simplicity of life and the reality of death, while the fool senselessly parades around and preoccupies their time with things in the moment without any regard for the future. And by doing that, they stumble toward death, and more likely a premature one. Proverbs 21:6 says that the consequences of foolishness is that they are a road that leads to death. And so the distinction is the fool pursues pleasure as an end, trying to grasp at this false and trivialized sense of what truly matters in life. And so the meaning of their life, they see, is bound up in this conceited pursuit of self-gratification. And laughter and merrymaking are often used as a way to mask the pain and realities of life. People use comedy and humor as a way to sort of cover over things that they would rather not feel or understand. It's almost like they're using it to drown out the noise in life and to avoid problems rather than facing them head on and dealing with them. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 13 says that even in laughter, the heart might be in pain, and the end of joy may be grief. Somebody can have a smile on their face and can be laughing, but inside, that's not their heart. Their heart could be hurting, but yet on the outside, it doesn't seem that way. Our world has always been filled with this sort of culture of escapism. Many people look for something to numb the pain of daily life that they can't seem to really cope with. And they look for fun as a solution to life's responsibilities, or at least a relief from them. Because they're like, they're either overwhelmed or they're probably underwhelmed. Either life is overbearing and a person feels weighed down to the point of exhaustion that they need to find some sort of a temporary way out or they will suffocate. That's for the person who's overwhelmed. But on the other hand, it could be that a person finds life so banal and disenchanting and there's this lack of satisfaction on the whole enterprise that drives them to seek something more exhilarating, something that seems to fill life and spice it up and give some additional enjoyment that they can't seem to find in it, however temporary the experience might be. And so people resort to all kinds of ways to try to escape life, to try to be in the house of merrymaking, whether it's drugs, alcohol, sex, could be video games, TV, could be gambling, can be social media. There are endless outlets in life that can be used to escape reality. And people often get caught up in them because it's easier to sort of soothe ourselves with those things than to do the hard work of facing what comes in life. So Solomon is trying to point out that it's better to face life. It's better to embrace what is real. And for him, that is primarily focused on death. Death is real, and we should be living life in light of it. The next proverb he says is verse 5, it is better to listen to the rebuke of the wise than for man to listen to the song of fools. I'd say most of us probably don't like being corrected. I mean, it's not like, I guess, a happy thing for a lot of people. They'd rather be right. I mean, isn't that the way we normally would feel, that it's better for us just to be right than to have to be told we're wrong? I think that's a general sense that people have. But here Solomon's saying, it's better to listen to the rebuke that you get from the wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Everybody loves being praised by other people, right? It feeds our ego. But Solomon's saying that you could have a couple hundred fools singing the greatest song about you, and it's better to have one person rebuke you and help instruct you on the way of righteousness. I think some of us would probably struggle with wanting to hear the rebuke, because rebuke can be tense. We can feel in ourselves a sense of failure, a sense of inadequacy. That's just the weakness of our flesh, though. And Solomon's piercing through that and saying, listen to the instruction that comes from rebuke rather than people saying you're the greatest, rather than people patting you on the back. Well, there's nothing wrong with people liking you, but if you're just doing it to help pad your ego and to feel good about yourself, he's saying that's not as good as hearing somebody tell you the right way to do something, and then you now are better for it. Now, his explanation for this comes in verse 6, or I should say the justification for it. For as the crackling of burning thorns underneath a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is pointless. Interesting imagery he uses here of a fire being kindled beneath a pot. And he's saying that the crackling of burning thorns is just like the laughter of fools. Now, what's the resemblance there? Well, if you've ever tried to burn dried thorns, they light real easily and they make a lot of noise and they burn out real fast and don't provide a lot of heat. So it seems like it's real flashy. It makes a bunch of noise and then it's just gone. It doesn't actually accomplish the purpose for why you're lighting the fire, which is to heat the pot. Well, that's Solomon's explanation here, is that the song of fools, which is a parallel to the laughter of fools, the fool saying praiseworthy accolades and things like that about you, It's like the crackling noise that comes from thorns that are burning under a pot. They just seem to make a lot of noise, but don't really provide any real substance. And he says, this also is pointless. So while the wise people, somebody who's wise, is concerned with exhorting one another on how to walk a righteous and moral road in life, but the fools are more interested in just pursuing enjoyment and singing songs about themselves. So just as short-lived as the thorns are when they're burning, and that's just how the fools are. The thorns consume themselves so quickly that the fools are in like manner, what they're pursuing in their enjoyment is so fleeting that it can provide no lasting satisfaction. They might live the high life for a minute, but their flame quickly dies out. The next proverb in verse 7 continues on with wisdom and foolishness. But here, Solomon says, for extortion makes the wise man foolish. Wait a second, Solomon. So this is not a comparison between being wise and being foolish, and a bribe destroys the heart? This is a turning point in these series of proverbs that Solomon is listing here, where he's saying wisdom has value, but a wise person is susceptible. They're not immune. Wisdom can turn into foolishness. And the two things that he offers in order to categorize how that happens is through extortion and bribery. Now, why is extortion and bribery? Why are these the two things that Solomon is saying can make a wise man foolish and can destroy the wise person's heart? Well, money. Simple answer, money. Money, money, money. We seem to all be willing to do things for money. I remember when I was younger, one of the things that we used to always do if we wanted somebody to do something that probably wasn't a good idea to do, we'd try and bribe them. Right, tell them, I'll give you $20 if you will, and just fill in the blank. You know, it's better than a dare. I mean, maybe at some point dares work, but then at another point, money talks. People are willing to do things for money. It's not right, but hey, we know that that's the susceptibility of a person, that their heart is tempted when they see money is involved. And the same thing is with extortion, that if you have some dirt on someone, you know something, you then tell them, give me $20 and I won't tell anybody about it. It's almost like you're asking them to buy your silence. So in the ancient world, and maybe some places a lot in the modern world too, I would assume this is not something that's somehow gone out of style, but in a lot of cultures, money corrupts. People are corrupted by money. And whether you're a kid or you're a professional, a business person, or you're a politician, money has a way of working its way into a person's heart and twisting it. And then people start doing things that they never thought they'd do for the sake of money. So Solomon here is basically throwing doubt on this sort of exalted view of wisdom, that wisdom's great and all, and wisdom can do a lot, but a wise person can become a fool. Verse 8 says, better's the end of a matter than its beginning. This is similar to what we talked about previously, where sort of like a person's death, you know, the day that they die is better than the day that they're born. Here, the end of a matter is better than the beginning. That's a similar sentiment to that. And then a patient spirit is better than a proud spirit. I think he's offering here just some general wise advice that it's better to have a spirit of patience than to be arrogant and proud and to just be going headfirst into things, being rash, but rather sort of like being patient and just sitting and waiting. Now, why is sitting and waiting preferred to the proud spirit? Does it matter that things you take longer to do things than be proactively just going after them? Well, in Solomon's view, it's just about the heart. It's a matter of, well, what are you doing it for? Are you taking action because you want to be recognized, because you want to be first, because you want everybody to appreciate you? That pride, he says, is not good. The person who is slow and deliberate, who thinks things through, who considers the beginning with the end in mind, how to go and how to proceed, these things come from a patient spirit. Now, the Hebrew is literally a long spirit. And then the proud spirit is a high spirit, the height of spirit versus the length of spirit. That somebody who's their tolerance in a situation for different things is like a rubber band. It stretches and can accommodate. Whereas the person who has the really tall, high spirit, they want to walk heads and shoulders above everybody so everybody can see them. Those are just some imagery from the Hebrew text there. Now, let's move on to the 9 and 10 here. Don't be hasty in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. So he's warning about the detrimental use of anger and the way it can flare up and cause a person to act out in ways that are unhealthy and harmful. And then in verse 10, this one is my favorite of the series of Proverbs. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For it's not from wisdom that you ask this. The former days, don't say, why were the former days better than these days? What Solomon's trying to say through this proverb is that the people who look at the past and they favor it or they prefer it to whatever is present, he's saying this is not from wisdom, which is his way of framing it in the sense of it's foolish. It's foolish to look at the past and long for those days. Some people, I think, are stuck in the past because they think the past was maybe the better part of their life. Perhaps 20 or 30 years ago, they wish they could go back and they could relive those days again. There's a famous song by Bruce Springsteen that talks exactly about this principle. The beginning of the song goes, he talks about a friend he knew who was a very good baseball player. And he ended up running into him one day outside of a bar. And they went in and had a couple drinks together. And all he did was talk about the glory days. Glory days. Also reminds me of a movie a number of years ago. It's an animated movie called The Incredibles. In The Incredibles, it's about a family of superheroes. And the dad, he finds himself in middle-aged man with a family and three, you know, a wife and three kids and everything. And he's stuck at an insurance job behind a desk that he can't stand. And in the movie, he ends up beginning to long for and wanting to go back to the days when he was younger and was fighting crime. He wants to go back to those glory days so much that he and his friend, who's another superhero, they start listening to a radio scanner on Wednesday evenings and become masked vigilantes, trying to live the days when they were superheroes because they had to go into hiding, essentially, and protective services. I think we all kind of get stuck sometimes on thinking about the past and preferring it, thinking, weren't times better back then? But Solomon's whole premise is that the past is not any better than the present, and the present's not any better than the future, that everything is all on the same scale. So to think that whatever was is better than whatever is and is better than whatever will be is essentially just a foolish thought. All right, verse 11, wisdom with an inheritance is a good thing and an advantage for those who see the sun. Wisdom with an inheritance, essentially he's trying to point to that wisdom along with money is a good thing and an advantage for those who see the sun. So passing along an inheritance, he's saying, is good for the people who come after you, who see the sun, who are alive. So essentially, when at the end of your life, when you die and you give whatever you have to whoever's next, it can be an advantage for them. That is a wise thing to pass along wealth. Now, Proverbs talks a lot about this as well, that it is wise to give an inheritance to your children. But previously, Solomon has sort of had there's a little bit of a conundrum. He's looked kind of disparagingly on the idea that after you die, there's nothing left for you. But he has in mind here, not the person who dies, but what happens to people who are still under the sun, who see the sun, which is in his phrasing is just mean that they're still alive. After you're gone, these other people are still alive. If you give an inheritance to them, it can be an advantage to help them. And we've already kind of covered some of the things that can bring for a person if they're trying to start a business, maybe go to school or have other investment ideas, that some of that capital can be very helpful in starting the next generation off. Verse 12, for wisdom is a defense, even as money is a defense. But the advantage of the knowledge of wisdom is that it preserves the life of him who has it. Wisdom is a defense, even as money is a defense. Well, wisdom and money are not being connected to each other here as much as it is that wisdom is being likened to what money can do. They're both being likened to this sort of a military metaphor of protection and defense, that wisdom can help defend a person just like money can. Now, we're not talking about hiring lawyers or things like that. The money as a defense comes as in terms of a reservoir of being able to draw upon it in times of need. And wisdom is like a defense in the sense that it can be there when you need it and help you in times when you need to make decisions that are vital. Just like money, if you end up coming on hard times and you have some money, it can be used to then provide the means to survive through it and avoid some suffering. But the advantage of wisdom and the knowledge of it is that it preserves the life of him who has it. It helps to bring life and to fullness so that you are living the life with the value and purpose that God intended. It's not limited. Money, even though it is limited, wisdom is not. Sometimes you'll have money and then it might be gone. It has limited value and limited time. You might fall on hard times where money is used up. But wisdom is never used up. Wisdom is not a commodity of which you might have some at one point and then not at another. Now, if you turn from being a wise person to a foolish person, sure, you're forfeiting wisdom there. But wisdom is not something that has a time value to it or a quantity to it. And so while money can help in many ways and offer protection from some harsh realities in life, it's just a tool and something to use. Whereas wisdom is an approach to life. Wisdom is a matter of the heart and helps and can be the basis to help you make choices and take action to avoid pain and hardship in life and achieve peace and prosperity. All right, the final verses here in chapter 7. So Solomon concludes here from his series of Proverbs by saying, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? Consider the work of God. This is a phrase that Solomon's using to talk about the way God has ordered the world, the way that God's work in the world appears to him. And what he says here is he sees a world that's not straight, it's bent, it's crooked. The world is not working right in his view. And because he attributes everything to God in his framework, his base of knowledge is that the world is the way it is because God has ordered it this way. This is the way the world operates and doesn't change. It's fixed. And so if this is the way God has ordered the world, he's saying nobody can change that. You can't take what's crooked in his mind and then make it different. You can't straighten it out, meaning that a person can't take the world and turn it to their viewpoint. Our viewpoint and our experience of the world is whatever it is, not whatever we want it to be. And in Solomon's view, the world's broken. It's broken and there's nothing to do about it. So if that's the case, in verse 14, he says, in the day of prosperity, then, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other in order that man cannot find out anything about his future. So the end of the matter is you have a day, a season where you're prospering, rejoice, be joyful, be glad. And then you have a season or a day when you're facing adversity and hardship. And he says, well, consider this. God made both. God made the days of prosperity. God made the days of adversity in order that man cannot find out anything about his future. Solomon is giving everything to God. He's saying, we can't, as limited humans, we can't know the things that God knows, and we can't do the things that God does. Therefore, the future is out of our hands. We are to just live life as it is. And this is part of his theory, I think, he's leading toward, which we're going to uncover some more later on down the road in Ecclesiastes, that some of the solution that people struggle with is enjoying life for what it is. Whether it's a day of prosperity or it's a day of adversity, we're not all-knowing, can't see the future, but we do know the one that does, and we can trust in the one who does know the future, because as humans, we are to sit beneath God, not contend with him. So this is the end of chapter 7 on Ecclesiastes, and we're to consider the work of God that Solomon is saying, this is the way that the world is, and we're not going to change it. So let's live in a way according to that, with everything in mind that reality brings, especially death, being mindful of how we live, whether wisdom is being used, whether we have the joy and the satisfaction that comes with having wealth or being poor. So we'll see you next time as we continue on in Ecclesiastes.